We are in chapter 11. We'll start in verse 17 here in a second. We've got the rest of this chapter to finish up, and then we got two chapters after that, and then we'll be done with Hebrews. Obviously, this chapter is about faith. Many call it the roll call of faith, the hall of faith, and rightly so with all of these individuals that are duly noted, starting with Abel and going all the way through Rahab, and even some more that he mentions just almost on the side because of his lack of time to mention them in detail, as he's done slightly with these individuals. So just before we start, we talked about Abel and his sacrifice. We talked about Enoch and Noah and Abraham. And we'll talk a little bit more about Abraham and a different side of his faith that he showed through his obedience. And we'll talk about others as well. Why is he talking about faith in this chapter? What point is he getting at, and what really the foundation is why he's writing this chapter of faith and giving all these examples?
Because the people had been trying to go back to the old law and to works and doing the stuff they did before, and throughout Hebrews he's told them, you got the better thing. It's already, so you need to have faith. You need your faith because this is what is better for you. This is what you need, and faith is better than what you had in the past. And he's just showing all these people how their works, basically showing what good works they get by their faith. And that's kind of what this chapter is about.
Right. He's getting at that point of warning them away from apostatizing. He's talked about this earlier in the chapter and talked about the faith that they need to have and all these better things within this new covenant. And the reason they're turning away is in part of persecution, but also this lack of perseverance and endurance through these things in waiting out life for the promise that ultimately will be received in the end, because God cannot go back on his promise. And he makes the note throughout Hebrews that this promise is only found in the new covenant. And this is the new covenant which has been established, and this old covenant's done away with, and this is why you need to maintain that faith. At the end of chapter 10 in verse 39, he says, "We are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul." And that's an introduction into this chapter of faith. He has confidence that these brethren he's writing to are not going to fall away to the point of losing their salvation, but they're going to endure and they're going to believe to the point of the saving of their soul, realizing that their soul is not yet 100% saved. They have to continue and endure through this. It's something that is a lifelong process and is ultimately consummated upon their death, and that's their life is through, their fate is decided, or when Christ comes again, when we receive that promise. And so he's gone through talking about faith. Just to introduce into tonight, when we start in verse 17, note the first verse. The faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. As we noted before, that's not a concrete definition that this is exactly and only what faith is, but it's something that's included in faith. And this has that reference to the point he's making with regard to this chapter and enduring on to the promise in fulfilling their lives as Christians and ultimately attaining that promise. Faith will show you the evidence of what you need to see in order to maintain what you're going through at this time. You have a hope of heaven, and faith shows you that that hope is a real hope and it's not a false hope, and then it's that evidence of things not seen. You have faith in God, even though you don't see him. You have faith in the promise that he has made, even though you don't see that promise. And so it's as if they have all the proof they need through their faith. And he's getting on to this. And we see that through the different examples going on, that they have a promise or there's something that's going to happen that hasn't yet happened. And they do something by faith because it's as if it had already happened. They have that much confidence in whatever it is that's coming to pass. We talked about that with Abel and his faith that he showed in the obedience to God and that promise. Enoch walked by faith. Noah was divinely warned of things not yet seen, and he prepared that ark throughout all this time, being mocked throughout the time and preaching to those who rejected that gospel throughout the time. Abraham obeyed when he was told to go out to a place that was promised, and he never saw the fulfillment of that promise. It was never his land. He went out anyways, and he dwelt in it as a pilgrim, ultimately looking forward to that hope of heaven. And on top of all that, in verse 13 through 16, talks about that idea of us being pilgrims on this earth. And ultimately, we're not going to see that until Christ comes again, or, you know, we're going to die and our life is over, and then Christ comes again and that promise is fulfilled. So ultimately, no one is going to see the fulfillment of the promise until Christ comes. So there's going to be those who are alive when Christ comes, or we're all going to die in faith. So it's inevitable that we're not going to see the promise until that last day. And so this applies to everyone there will ever be. Any comments or questions before we get into this last section of chapter 11? Okay. Do you need a chapter 11? Okay. All right. Starting in verse 17, it says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'And Isaac, your seed shall be called,' concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each one of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones." Like we said before when we started chapter 11, you could go into details about every single facet of their lives and the faith that they professed and they showed, but we're only going to look at what the Hebrew writer has given us because we're studying Hebrews. So having that in mind, we're going to look at what he talks about here. Obviously, it's a little generalized as we go on, but we're still just going to look at it. Starting in verse 32, he'll just make mention of certain individuals and not go into any detail about them. And then he'll talk about generally about things that Christians and people of faith in general have gone through. And we're just going to look at them as he has made note. Okay, first off, by faith Abraham offered up Isaac, who had received the promises. He offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "And Isaac, your seed shall be called." And so this was another facet of Abraham's life in which he showed his faith. Before, it talked about obeying and going out to this place of promise, even though it would not yet be his, believing God that he would be able to bear a son, even though old in age and his wife's womb is already dead, and talking about the pilgrimage he had on this earth. Now he gets on to this even more extreme display of faith. And really we see two sides of this test. One, that it tests his obedience, and then it tests his trust or faith in God's promise, which he had. It says that he was tested. So this was a test God was giving him. Told him to go up and offer up Isaac. Now, just as parents, obviously, you know how hard that must have been. It says this is his only begotten son. Was this Abraham's only son?
No.
Okay, so what's he getting at there? His only begotten son.
The son to whom the promise would be
right.
Realized.
Okay. Some translations, I think, have the beloved son. So it's not his only son, but his only son through whom the promises would be fulfilled. Do you have something? Okay, so he's that only begotten son in that sense, that this is how God's promises are going to be fulfilled. And keep in mind that he knew of these promises, and he knew that it was only through Isaac. And so when God told him to offer him, he had to have faith that, one, he was going to somehow fulfill this promise throughout this, and two, that he was going to reward him upon his obedience and fulfilling those ultimate promises. It said that he offered up Isaac, who he had received the promises, and offered up his only begotten son, in whose seed you shall be called. And so he is the seed. He is the son of promise in which the seed would come. And that's the ultimate obedience. When we compare this to your own love for your child, and I guess you can see it from the other side, as a child loving his father or mother, how hard it would be to forsake your only son or your relative and do that for God. In Matthew 10 and verse 37, Jesus talks about forsaking father and mother. You can't love them more than me. And that's one of the things that Abraham had to note. He had more of a love for God than he did for his only son, his son of promise, Isaac. And ultimately, that was a test of his obedience to God and his love for God in that. And so that tested his love. It tested his trust and God's promise. He says in verse 19, after he had offered him up, it was while he was doing this that he was concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Yes, Randy.
Would that explanation is not in Genesis? Would that explanation have to be something that was revealed to whoever the writer is by the Holy Spirit? Or is that something that was
what I just read in verse 19?
Thought of or generally known?
In verse 19?
Yeah. In Genesis, well, there's no explanation that Abraham considered that God could raise somebody from the dead. That's the first time you ever hear that. It's no
That's not just a guess at why Abraham had the faith in doing this. This is what Abraham was thinking, because this is by inspiration.
That it had been revealed by the Holy
Spirit. Well, yes.
Or either it was widely known by the people at that time, the story passed down, but more likely by the Holy Spirit.
Right. Yeah, I think obviously that through this inspiration of this epistle to the Hebrews, that this is what Abraham was thinking at that time. Also, what we see through this is that this is what Abraham was thinking, and then he offered up his son, but this was not what God was going to do. This was never God's plan. And so you can have that thought process of something, maybe God's going to do this, maybe God's going to do that, and it can be harmless so as it does not inhibit you from following through obediently. Abraham thought that he was going to kill his son, and then somehow God was going to raise him up from the dead, or something was going to happen. It says that it was concluding that God was able to do this. That word concluding is the word, I think it's logizomai, something like that, the Greek word. It means to put to account, to take inventory. So this was something that he had already considered was possible. God is going to do this. If I slay my son, he's promised the seed through Isaac, so he is going to do this. This is as if God has already said he's going to do this. And that's the faith that Abraham had. He's got this command to kill his son, and that through that son, he's going to receive the promise. So this is the only logical explanation that he had. Of course, we know that God stopped him as he was about to do this. But it said he received him in a figurative sense. And so he already thought of Isaac as being dead there. He had not yet slayed him, but he had already received him in that sense. This is done. No one's going to stop me. You know, I'm going to obey God. This is done. And so he had that full faith, that full decision. But ultimately, God stopped him. Any comments or questions about that? Okay, continuing on, says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Here again, of course, we don't have the full detail of this, but how might it be by faith that he blessed those? Why did it take faith to bless his sons? Okay. Okay.
He also believed in the promise that was made to Isaac and Abraham and Isaac and now him with Jacob and Esau. And,
right.
And even though he was old in age and he got tricked into doing it, he still believed in the promise and he wanted to bless. So he had faith that it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he blessed his son. So
okay.
To give all, the regular blessing and the blessing.
When would he bless his? When would he do it without understanding that God was going to fulfill it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he considered it already done. That's
right.
What faith hears.
Absolutely. Yeah, he blessed them concerning things to come, not things that were there. So the blessings that he gave in Genesis 27:29, he says, let the people serve you and nations bow down to you, he said to Jacob. And this, obviously, he thought it was Esau at the time. And through that deception, But that blessing showed that faith. I'm blessing you. These things haven't happened. We don't see them yet, but it's going to happen. And this is the blessing you shall receive. And even further than that, he had faith in God's providence. As Charlotte noted, that Jacob was deceptive in what he did. And Isaac thought that that was Esau. And so when that blessing was made, and all of a sudden he came to the realization that I blessed the wrong person, and Esau came back and he was like, you know, take it back from him, you know, bless me, or what can you do for me? He didn't relent for what he had done. And so he had faith even further that even though it wasn't traditional, God's going to be able to perform what he has said. And these blessings are going to come to pass. Comments, questions about that? Just let me know if you have any. And so there was that direction by the Hebrew writer to this concept of having faith in things yet to come, even with regard to this. And it says, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on top his staff. So we have, once again, the similar idea of blessing. He blessed Ephraim and Manasseh as his own sons. Ultimately, they went on to be the biggest tribes of that the Israel, and he blessed them as his own. In doing so, he noted this importance of worship and blessing and having faith in God when he was close to the point of death. He was old and decrepit, and he was leaning on his staff, couldn't even stand by himself, and he was still worshiping, and he was still having faith in God's promises, even though it was obvious already nearing the end of his life that he wasn't going to be able to see these things come about. Yet, with that faith, he had confidence to bless these individuals. Comments, questions about that? It's kind of, you know, stop, we're going to talk about this, and then stop, we're going to talk about this. It's kind of staggered, but we'll get through it. And then verse 22 says, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. This is something that's pretty neat to me. I mean, the whole chapter is, but for some reason, I don't know why, this one kind of stuck out to me. He wasn't dead yet. Nothing was happening yet of the fulfilling of the promise ultimately, and yet he gave instructions to, you know, I'm going to die inevitably. Take my body with you to go to that promised land, as if, you know, that took a lot of confidence and faith in God's ability to fulfill that promise. Yes.
That meant that, I imagine a lot of years have passed and Joseph was dead, but that meant that those promises that were laid to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and his sons were talked about. Joseph believed them.
Right.
By faith. And, you know, I'm sure after I count through all what they went through, I would think, that's not going to happen. We're here. We're here in this foreign land. We never going to get to go. We're slaves.
Right. Well,
probably it would have been after Joseph's death.
Joseph gives me hope. Like, if you think about Joseph's life, he was only in Hebrew country for 17 years. Mm-hmm. The rest of his life, he was an Egyptian. He was not really ever, I guess he was accepted because of his authority, but not because of his, you know, right, race or whatever. But he was still a Hebrew in his heart.
Right. Same with Moses.
You know
too.
How people want to go back home to their own place to be buried?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It shows his faith not only in the, you know, faith he had that God was going to fulfill his promise, but ultimately his main priority. And that's what we see throughout this chapter of Hebrews, is the correlation between faith and having your priorities set straight. And by this faith that he had, even when he first got into Egypt till the end of his days, it was always about God and his people. He wasn't an Egyptian at heart, like you said. And it's the same with Moses being born in Egypt and raised as an Egyptian and such. It was always about God and his people. He was a Hebrew at heart. He was one of God's people. Any other points on Joseph there? Okay, in verse 23, we get into talking a little bit about the faith of Moses there. In verse 23, really about his parents. And in verse 29, Joseph is still almost the center point, but he doesn't mention him specifically there in that verse, talking really about the faith of the Israelites in their exodus. But beginning in verse 23 and going through 29, we see this section of Moses. We've been talking about Abraham starting in verse 8, and really through verse 20 or 19. And so now we're going to jump ahead to another period of time with regard to Moses, as we just talked about the patriarchs. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. So first off, in verse 23, we have the faith of his parents. And in the account in Genesis, it talks about his mother's faith. But note that his father had that same faith, because it talks about his parents, plural. But when he was born, he was hidden 3 months by his parents. They saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. What was the situation there at this time? Why did they have to hide him?
Well, maybe the Herod put out an order, Pharaoh put out an order, babies should be killed, babies should be killed under a certain age.
Okay. And so there was that fear that would be present at that time. But instead of fearing that king, I guess you could say they had a respect for God, that kind of fear for God and his promises and his plan and such. As Moses was a part of that plan, they hid him, seeing him as that beautiful baby. And so that was this faith that they showed as being Moses' parents. And ultimately, as we see, the faith of God's people is used to fulfill his ultimate scheme of redemption for mankind. And we see it all connected throughout this, starting with Abel, going all the way through the end of the Old Covenant. He uses people providentially throughout time to fulfill his promises. And so faith of the people was absolutely necessary in these situations. So they hid the baby. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Here is a situation, you know, that really is emphasized to me, that he refused to be called her daughter, her son. And this was something that he had been involved in throughout his entire life. Did he know his Hebrew mother and father very well? You know, you just consider that he grew up as Pharaoh's daughters being his mom. And then he recognized the importance. Just like Abraham had to forsake all to follow God and sacrificing his only begotten son, here's his mother that he's known, you know, obviously not physically, biologically, but here's his mother he grew up knowing, taking care of him and all of this, and he refused to be called her son because here's his main purpose in life.
He's 40 years old, and all this starts going down.
Mm-hmm.
You think all during that time he refused, or just toward the...
It said when he came of age. This was...
Came of age?
Yeah, it says in verse 24, when he became of age. This was when he was mature. So this was this wasn't an act of rebellion. You're not my mommy, and
so
running away. It was...
around 20, so usually they considered the man around 20.
I didn't look into
so
that.
At all that age, but for 20 years, if he refused, how did they leave him in time? I mean, how did he keep his status?
I don't think he was disobedient as a child. He was obedient, and when he came of age, when he decided to be on, you know, I'm not an Egyptian, I'm going to do this or whatever.
Well, you know, I would think more likely, you know, as Pharaoh's daughter, as most of her kids, they had these people raised him. And mm-hmm. I think it was Moses' mother that actually raised him.
Right.
So she had the greater influence over him than anybody. You know, person there, probably that kid probably loves them more than they do their mom, and respects them more so than that. So, you know, that is a question you wonder about is, all of a sudden, when did mom spring this on you? You know,
right.
As a little child, you're telling them, you're my kid, well, you gonna, he gonna let that slip and tell it. So there had to be some sort of great respect for the real mother here, that he was able to trust her and that for this plan to work.
Yeah, there was an ultimate influence from the Hebrew side of things. But it was ultimately when he came of age that he made this decision on his own. And so it wasn't an act of rebellion toward Pharaoh's daughter or anything. It was an act of, you know, responsibility. This is what I have to do, and that's what I'm going to choose. Wayne, did you have something?
Yeah, this is what you said. You know, God's plan was to save his life. He was hid for 3 months and then deliberately let the Pharaoh's daughter find him. And then his mother, his actual mother, raised him.
Right.
And the Bible didn't say how long, but obviously he was taught from then on that he was a Hebrew, not a...
Right, yeah, it wasn't spontaneous, in other words.
So he lived a double life, basically,
yeah,
until he was 40 years old.
Okay, yeah.
And then he made this... Well, the decision was made for him when he killed the Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty simple to me. His mother told him who he was, and he grew up knowing who he was.
Right, yeah, and the contrast here, though, is the double life. He had a choice, ultimately, as we all do. I mean, he chose the life of the child of God rather than being an Egyptian. That's where he gets at that point.
But you know, even the Pharaoh's daughter probably realized that this was a Hebrew child when she took him in.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know the difference between the Hebrews and the Egyptians, but skin tone or characteristics or whatever, if there would be any difference between that. But, you know, she knew more than likely what was going on to find a lady floating the river, that it was probably some mom trying to save her child at his age. You know, but, you know, she did it. And, you know, again, that's God's providence that worked out.
Oh, yeah.
It was like it was predestined. He knew, along with his mother telling him all the time, but it was up to his decision.
Right.
He could have chosen one, so it was like it was predestined for him.
Is absolutely. And I think that's why it says when he became of age. He was mature. It was his decision. And so he ultimately made that on his own. Obviously, an influence played a role in this. But also, there might have been an influence on the other side of things. Maybe Pharaoh's daughter was hoping that he would choose the Egyptians, you know.
Well, actually,
and so there was that.
We were looking it up here, and it showed me that in Exodus chapter 2, verse 6, and when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him, and she said, this is one of the Hebrew children.
Right, yeah, she knew. Right. Yeah, that's what I thought I remembered. Okay, it says, ultimately, the point he's making is that he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. And so, obviously, there were those pleasures there, as in the Egyptian culture, and many of them sinful, obviously, as we see here. And he recognized that those were passing. And he understood there was a promise. Now, knowing that you know, obviously not knowing yet, but we know that eventually he'd get to that point where he wouldn't even get to enter in the promised land. But ultimately, the promise is of these riches in heaven that every single one of these individuals are ultimately looking forward to and having a priority with. And he recognized the eternal nature of that and the importance of being a child of God and obedient in that and the passing pleasures of sin. And that's obviously something that's applicable to us. It said that he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. How might there be that connection with Christ there?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, how did Christ enter into this one little part here? There were three promises, and Christ was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, through the Hebrew lineage, these leaders knew promise was down the road through the seed, through their seed, through all of the sins, that there was going to be someone or something that would bless the, all the nations. That was a promise. Mm-hmm. And they knew it. And so he didn't know Christ as
we know him at this time.
You know, but he knew the Messiah was coming. Mm-hmm. That was one of the three promises.
Right. I think that's really the connection there. Some, you know, Christ is not, the word is not specifically Jesus. So some say it's referring to something else as I was reading, but I think that's the most likely connection. He knew of the promise of the seed and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. This was something that was understood in their history as Hebrews, Israelites. And ultimately, he chose all the reproaches of Christ, of the things that would take to get to that promise. He knew it wouldn't be smooth sailing to that land of Canaan. He knew it wouldn't be smooth sailing in conquering that land of Canaan. He knew that, you know, all of those reproaches that would come with them trying to exit Egypt, most likely, wasn't going to be something smooth sailing as we saw. And so he esteemed those things greater riches than the things that he already had at hand in Egypt, and that shows the faith that he took. It says, for he looked to the reward, and ultimately that would be the redemption in Christ. All the nations of the earth shall be blessed through that seed promise. And he recognized the need for that. Any comments or questions about that? Okay, it says, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. So again, he forsook Egypt. He knew of God and his power and his ability to fulfill promises and all this that's happening. And he has everything that anyone could ever want in Egypt and all the power and all the riches and pleasures and stuff. And he forsook all of that because he knew, you know, God's what it's all about. And that's what he's going to follow, who he's going to follow. So that's another thing. It says, him who is invisible. We have to know that he is, and he's a rewarder, those who diligently seek him, in verse 6. And that applies to everyone in this passage, but we see it obvious here. He knew of the invisible, had full faith that he existed, and that he's going to reward him and follow up on these promises given to these individuals. It says, by faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. So in this we see the faith it takes to have a belief, a full firm conviction that, you know, something's going to pass over and kill all the firstborn children, you know. And they had already seen all these other plagues, so that probably could strengthen faith, but he had to have the faith to take what was necessary in order for that not to happen to his household. And also we note the faith that this is comparable to what Noah had to do. There was all these limitations and specifications about the ark, and it's the same with the Passover feast. We know that there was instruction given as to how they were to do these things and prepare these things, and that's part of faith, is fulfilling all these commands to the letter as God has given us. So he had faith in that way as well in preparing these things, and ultimately having faith that God would follow up on what he had already told them he was going to follow up on. Comments, questions on that? Okay, moving away from Moses specifically into the general Israelites. It says, by faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. Initially, we see in that account where they were complaining and murmuring. They were at this sea and the Egyptians were drawing in on them, and they were talking about how, you know, we should go back, or why didn't you keep us there and all this stuff. And we remember Moses saying, stand and see God work about your salvation. And obviously a paraphrase, he's going to deliver you and such like that. And ultimately you had to have faith to go through that, even if it wasn't initial. And Moses had to have faith as a leader, influencing them into that as he stood up and had that confidence and faith in God. It says that the Egyptians, on the other hand, contrary, they attempted to do so, that they were drowned. They tried to cross that same Red Sea, but they didn't get all the way through. They were destroyed because the waters came down, and this was primarily because they didn't do it by faith. It wasn't for them. They were just assuming that these things were going to stay up, you know, they didn't take into account, I guess, that God's doing this, and he's letting those people go through that are following him and having faith in him. We could care less about him. Let's try to get through here and squeeze through here. And they came down. So there's the contrast. You can try and do things and try and do things. You can try to get to heaven and attain salvation, but without faith, it is impossible to please him. Without faith, it is impossible to do this. And this is a working understanding of this and application, that by faith the children of Israel passed through, they made it. And without faith, the Israelites or the Egyptians tried to do the exact same thing, didn't work for them. And so that applies to any facet of our lives. Any comments or questions about that section about Moses? Okay, well, let's see. Okay, we're going to finish up. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. Here's another thing comparable to this instruction given to Noah and the instruction given for the Passover and all these specific things. Even Cain and Abel, they had to do something, and they had to do it specifically as God said. And they had to have faith while doing these things that whatever they're doing it for is going to happen. So obviously, the walls tumbled down, not because of what they were doing inherently, but because of the faith they had in God's power to do this. And then going over to verse 31, likewise related to this story of Jericho, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. What do we remember her saying to those spies that really displayed her faith? Not specifically, just generally.
Well, she believed, she heard what all happened.
Exactly.
No. And she believed it. And
right.
She knew that God was going to take that place. So she said, when y'all do take this place, would you spare me?
Right. So there's another.
That she believed they were going to take it.
Exactly. She had heard of all these things. Did she see them? No. So there's faith. I have faith that this is going to happen. And she acted upon that. Here's another thing, that as Abraham chose God over Isaac, Moses choosing God over his Egyptian family or whatever you might call that, you have Rahab choosing God and the Israelites and all of this over her people in Jericho, over that king, over that place, and over all of that she had. And she chose God, and ultimately, out of faith, was able to be spared. She received those spies, so she aided and abetted these spies, and ultimately that was out of that faith, because God was going to take over the land. She said that, I know that God has given you Jericho. In other words, you know, it's inevitable. I can't do anything about it, so I might as well help you. She had that faith. And then he goes in to talk about all these other individuals in general. Says, and what more shall I say, for the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. And then he goes on to describe a little bit of what these individuals as a whole have gone through. Obviously, we could talk a lot about these individuals, but like he said, what more can I say? How much time do I have? Same thing for us. It says, these people who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to fight the armies of the aliens. Notice he said Samuel and the prophets. And so these are people that he just mentioned, and then people that he didn't specifically mention. The prophets could include all of those individuals like Elijah, Elisha, and Daniel, and so on and so forth. These people accomplished these seemingly impossible things. They obtained promises, meaning God promised something and they received that promise, or they had been given promises by God. Either way is true. And so they went through all of this, and it was all by faith. And he's making this point, obviously, even stronger. He says, women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And so you have this opportunity to give in sometimes when you're being tortured or persecuted or whatever it may be. Not all the time. Sometimes you're going to be given this opportunity. If you say this, or if you deny God, if you decide to forsake Him and come after us or whatever, you have that with Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We won't throw you in the fire if you fall down and worship this idol, and they decided not to. So all of these things. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. So all this persecution, the testings, the trials, the tribulations these individuals had to go through, all are likewise men and women who walked in faith that are just as important as these individuals who he made note of earlier. It said, of whom the world was not worthy. The world rejected them. And we talk about that. The world's going to reject us. It rejected Christ. It rejected all these men of faith that we're talking about here. But they recognized that this place was temporary. As he talked about in verse 13 through 16, talking about being pilgrims on earth, that our place is in heaven. These people had that same understanding. And to sum it all up, he says in verse 39, and all these, and when he says all these, he's talking about all these people he has mentioned and all the people of faith before that he hasn't mentioned. Anybody that was before you that had this faith, all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. We know in the previous chapters that Jesus, in verse 12 of chapter 10, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God from that time awaiting for his enemies to be made his footstool. For by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. That's the perfection that he's talking about here. In chapter 9 and verse 15, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant by means of death through the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. This all was consummated under this establishment of the new covenant, Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, ascension into heaven. And so we have this, didn't happen apart from us who are under this new Christian dispensation. And so that promise ultimately being fulfilled and consummated through Christ's death, and then that promise of heaven that has not yet been fulfilled. So these obtained this good testimony. You have faith, you're good, we're talking about you and all of this stuff. You have a hope, you died in faith, you died in hope, but you didn't come to this promise and the fulfillment of it until this start of this new covenant, and ultimately when Christ comes again and we get that crown of righteousness. Any comments or questions about chapter 11? And keep in mind that although we can make different applications to this chapter, he's talking about them enduring through and not falling away from this faith that they have and the necessity of this faith. Any comments or questions? Yes, you have something?
Well, no, I was just thinking, I mean, still, we know that we're under the new law, right there, but we still have to look under the old law to get to where we are. We just can't stand it. We know we're under the new law.
Right. Yeah, Galatians chapter 3. It's a tutor to bring us to Christ. And elsewhere, we have this as something to teach us. It's for our learning. And to understand the new covenant in various places, you have to know some stuff about the old covenant. And so just mentioning all these people, they have the same hope. They have the same requirements of faith that we have. That's why we could be Abraham's descendants and heirs according to that promise in Romans 4, because he was justified and accounted righteous before circumcision. So it was by faith through grace. And so this is the same requirement for us. Any comments or questions? So we'll get into chapter 12 and the application specifically to the Hebrews of chapter 11 and everything previous.